SDF conferencing system. There are four other parties in
we'll
this conference.
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here, and H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
And I hope you...
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here, and H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in. Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Okay, I think that's all working now. So, it is Saturday the 27th of May in the glorious future year of 2023. And I am coming to you from Fort Worth, Texas, having returned here earlier in the week. And I do have to say, I am disappointed. Deeply disappointed. I got back on Tuesday. I picked up my accumulated mail from my post office box. And there were no letters from listeners, no cards. Even though I try to end every episode by saying, send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. And I'll probably read out your letter over the air. And I'll very likely send you something back if there is a return address. But alas, nothing. So I have no listener contributions to read in this show. Which means I'll just have to make something up as usual. Now, what am I going to talk to you about today? Well, there's a very interesting scholarly paper, academic paper out there somewhere, with a title, Reading Hamlet in Africa, or Reading Hamlet Among the Yaoundé, or something. Hold on, let me check. Shakespeare in the Bush. Shakespeare in the Bush, Reading Hamlet Among the Teev. Anyway. One of the things that's mentioned in this very interesting paper. Now, obviously, the first problem that the author encountered, the author was an anthropologist who was going to Africa to study a tribe called the Teev. And, sorry, I just got back from the store. That's why I'm a little more disorganized than usual. But had gone to West Africa or gone to Africa somewhere, Central Africa perhaps, to study a tribe called the Tiv and live with them for a while, learn about them, and had had a curious conversation with someone and decided, you know, I'm going to try to introduce these folks to the works of Shakespeare and see what they make of them, see what their perspective is. And of course, there were a lot of problems, because Shakespeare was writing for an audience who would be familiar with kings and sailing ships and sealing wax, you know. And so the person involved found it necessary to come up with analogies or substitute concepts, parallelisms, and so on, trying to explain certain things. And of course, when dealing with a society, for example, where they don't have, where monogamy is not, is certainly among the chiefs, not an assumption, for example, that adds an additional layer of complexity to talking about Hamlet, for example. Anyway, so the author says that they got to an absolute standstill at the point about the death of Ophelia, because the elders of the Tiv were quite insistent that there is no such thing as drowning. Water is harmless. It's what you drink, it's what you wash with, it cannot hurt you. They said, this was clearly the work of witches, and we know what to do about witches. That there's no such thing as what you call drowning. It's the result of witchcraft, and you have to find the witch. And here's the thing, right? Now, textually speaking, the text definitely supports a reading that Ophelia fell into the river and drowned because she was poisoned, probably by Gertrude. And of course, if you go back far enough, it turns out that poisoning and witchcraft are very closely connected concepts, the idea of harming someone secretly. You know, that the verse, which in the King James Bible says, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, can just as easily be read poisoner. But that's not the point. The thing is that in this community, in this tribe, any time someone had the misfortune to die by drowning, which is going to happen if you live anywhere near any kind of body of water, even one that doesn't have hippopotamus in it, some poor, innocent soul was hunted out by the witch finders, based on what criteria you is difficult to imagine, and put to death. Now, I'm not bringing this up in an attempt to say, oh, well, how wonderful and superior is our modern culture, you know. That's not my point here. Matter of fact, my point is practically the opposite. You see, if you think about it, you'll realize that all human cultures, in some sense, have had about the same amount of time to develop, right? We all diverge from a common ancestor. You know, there's no people who were just created suddenly a couple of hundred years ago. People may say, well, you know, there's these cultural breakpoints. You know, the settlement of America by Europeans, you know, creates a culture which is distinctive from the European cultures those folks came from, and to an extent that's fair. But the ultimate point here is, you know, anytime anyone says, oh, well, that organism is archaic, you have to think, well, it's been evolving for the same number of billions of years as anybody else. So clearly, if it needed to change, it's had plenty of time to make changes. And similarly with cultures. All human cultures are more or less the same age, if you look at it that way. And what do I mean by that? Well, I guess what I really mean is that if you are patting yourself on the back about your modern scientific culture and so on, I'll bet you, I'll bet you anything that your neighbors, maybe even you yourself, harbor ideas which are just as ill-founded, just as wrong-headed, just as back to front as those of the Tiv, who insist that anytime someone drowns, it's the work of a witch, and that witch must be found and put to death. Now, the trouble, of course, is finding them, right? The trouble is finding out what those beliefs that the people around you in your society, and even you yourself, hold, what those things are that you take for granted and yet are absolutely unjustifiable and wrong and destructive. I mean, I certainly haven't, for example, given up, you know, on trying to convince people that their radiophobia, their fear of nuclear energy and so on, is unjustified. But what else is there? And the problem, perhaps, does arise that in this modern world, there's an immense complexity, an immense depth of complexity. You know, I think of myself as a well-educated and intelligent person, and there are things that I do not know or understand. I was reading a paper, for example, about the teaching of mathematics, and how the way teaching of mathematics is taught in schools has absolutely nothing to do with the way that mathematicians, modern mathematicians, view mathematics. And they were talking about dividing by zero as one example. And they said, well, you know, the way it's often taught is that dividing by zero gets you, you know, into infinity or something undefined. But modern mathematics says that it drops you into the zero ring. I said, what the devil is a zero ring? Now, here's the thing. I'm not a professional mathematician. All right. I'm not a professional mathematician. And I say that as someone who is comfortable with the integral and differential calculus. Right? I say that as someone who has some familiarity with things like the imaginary number, the square root of negative 1, which is used in a lot of engineering mathematics. But I'm not a professional mathematician. So I go looking it up. And the zero ring, apparently, is a ring of characteristic zero. Well, that doesn't get me anywhere. What is this ring and what is its characteristic? Well, apparently, and again, I'm not a professional mathematician, I may be completely misstating this, but apparently, a ring is a field of numbers which is defined in various ways, but the characteristic of the ring is the number of times one must add the multiplicative identity to itself in order to obtain the additive identity. Now, the multiplicative identity is the number that you, in this number field, that you multiply any other number by, and the result is the other number unchanged. In our ordinary understanding, you know, the arithmetic used by everyone not a professional mathematician, that's unity or one. Right? You multiply anything by 1, you get the thing. Again, you multiply 99 by 1, you multiply minus 1,000 by 1, whatever it is you multiply by 1, you get 1. You get unity. Right? You get the number out that you put in. Whatever the quantity. In fact, it doesn't even have to be numbers. Right? In engineering mathematics, you make a lot of use of unit multipliers, such as 2.54 centimeters divided by 1 inch. That, because those things are defined to be the same, Right. That's a unit multiplier. That's a unity. You can multiply anything by it. Right? And there's all kinds of algebra that we do where we're multiplying by something which works out to be unity, works out to be one, so that we put something in a more convenient form. So, similarly, the additive inverse is the number that you can add to any other number and get that other number out unchanged. And in our ordinary, right, arithmetic that doesn't belong to the higher mathematics of the professional mathematicians, we call that zero, right? You add zero to anything, and you get the same number back unchanged. You multiply anything by one, and you get the same number back unchanged, right? Well, of course, in any sort of numeration that you're familiar with, you can add 1 to 1 to 1 to 1 to 1 to 1 any number of times you want, and you will never get 0. So the very definition that the characteristic of a ring is the number of times you add the multiplicative invariant to itself, the multiplicative identity, rather, to itself, to get the additive identity. In the kinds of numbers that those of us who are professional mathematicians are conversant with, that never happens at all. It's a meaningless definition. And so what am I to make of this? You know, as I say, I am generally an intelligent and well-informed person. And I'm conversant with what a century and a half ago would have been considered higher mathematics. And the things that professional mathematicians say sound like gobbledygook. And matter of fact, they sound just as meaningless or just as back to front as the idea that there's no such thing as drowning, it's all witchcraft, and you have to find and kill the witch. And this is a problem, right? It's a problem that we have fields of knowledge. I mean, it's not a bad problem, right? But it is a problem that we have fields of knowledge which are so broad and so, at the same time, so specialized, right? We now have such great amounts of knowledge in the world that nobody can effectively hope to synthesize them. And that's a problem for me, because exactly what I try to do here every week is to synthesize knowledge for you. And here I am admitting that I have no hope of doing that, because there are so many fields of endeavor in which, so far as anyone who hasn't devoted his entire life to them can see, the practitioners have disappeared entirely up their own backsides. But at the same time, none of that seems to justify or explain the things that I see going on in the world. I mean, just a quick example, I guess. I was looking in the Wall Street Journal, just on the front page, and there was a thing about, you know, Target is bullseye in the culture wars, and I'm thinking, And there's a little stinger which says, Target is being criticized for pulling Gay Pride Month merchandise after some online commentators and customers expressed distaste for it, or something. Well, the full story is actually there on, it starts on the bottom of the front page under the fold, and you can read that, no, actually, that's not what happened at all. It wasn't that people complained, It was that their store displays were knocked over and their employees were assaulted by people who, I don't know what their motive is exactly, but I would say that they intended specifically to force this outcome. The Target stores would be forced to take this merchandise off display in order to avoid having their store displays knocked over and their clerks assaulted. People who are not afraid to deploy violence, right, in support of political ends. And this is, of course, the definition of terrorism. And so somebody, there are some people who believe that these, you know, I don't know, rainbow-colored t-shirts or whatever are enough of a threat to their existence, to their worldview, to something or other, that they're willing to engage in, you know, this kind of violence. I mean, this isn't the first time something like this has happened. I remember going to Target a couple of years ago and noticing they had a placard up saying that they'd taken Pokemon trading cards off display because they were tired of having their employees assaulted. So, I don't know if that was people who thought that Pokemon are the devil, or whether it was people who were just trying to get Pokemon cards and were fighting each other. I'm not sure, but it was a bit disquieting. Because, of course, what I think is, this is merchandise that's on display in a retail store. It's not worth getting excited over. But I hear every year about people, you know, being crushed to death on Black Friday, the day after the Thanksgiving holiday in the U.S., where stores often offer bargains, but with very limited numbers in inventory, so you have to get there early to get them. And so people are killed, are actually killed, crushed to death, trying to, you know, mob the doors of these shops when they open first thing. I find it disgusting, but I also find it inexplicable. What is there about these products that are on display that could possibly be worth that? I mean, getting up at 5 in the morning is bad enough. Getting up at 5 in the morning to go participate in a mass suicide ritual in an attempt to get a television for 50% off? I literally cannot understand this behavior. It's one of the biggest problems that I have, honestly, is that there is this human behavior that I observe and cannot account for in any way, can make no accounting of. Yeah, I'm getting milkshake all over my trousers. It's terrible. But, you know, in this case, we have these folks who have decided, apparently, that acknowledging that there are, I don't know what you say, you know, that gender and sexual diversity exist, is somehow so horrible and so threatening that they're in, you know, entitled to use violence. None of this makes sense to me. All right? You know, maybe you can make sense of it. I can't. Just the same as, you know, I look at this business in Nebraska, where one legislator, Nebraska has a unicameral legislature. They stopped having two chambers as an economy measure during the Great Depression. They've also got the best Capitol building in the United States, hands down. You know, the Texas State Capitol is a model of the Capitol in Washington, built to be slightly larger, although, of course, then the Capitol in Washington was expanded. But the Nebraska State Capitol is a skyscraper, basically. It's really quite nifty. Anyway, so it's got all the you know, the legislative chambers themselves and all the offices and hearing rooms and so forth, all in this great big spike that rises out of the prairie in Lincoln. And it's, you know, of course, Nebraska being, aside from the bluffs of the Missouri, largely very flat, it can be seen from a long way away. It's very distinctive. But, you know, apparently the number one priority on the legislative agenda this year, the absolute first priority, was to push through one of these bills that says, you know, the state legislature knows better than doctors or anybody else, you know, what kind of health care kids need. I mean, this whole business, like I say, I don't think I'll ever understand the transgender thing. But, on the other hand, it's fairly well established that these kinds of interventions lower the suicide rate. And so I think that's really the only evidence that I need that there's something to it. But the majority in the Nebraska legislature doesn't agree with me, apparently, or at least the people who set the agenda. And so one legislator whose child would be personally affected by this legislation decided to filibuster it. And she's been filibustering it. The Nebraska state legislature has done nothing because the people in charge of the agenda refused to remove this item from the agenda. That's their absolute priority. That's what's more important to them than passing a budget. More important than passing anything is this piece of legislation which would affect relatively few people and for no obvious reason, right? But apparently someone in Nebraska believes that these, you know, handful of transgender kids are gnawing at the roots of the tree of liberty and they're going to destroy America and this, that, and the other thing. Anyway, and one of the other legislators said, "Your filibuster made me miss my grandson's graduation." To which the legislator doing the filibustering said, "I didn't make you do anything. You hate my family more than you love your own." And the reason I mention this on this long digression in the first place is that to say that, that's the sort of thing which ought to cause anyone to stop and reflect. But from what I can tell, you know, that's the sort of thing where if someone said that to you, you'd want to go home and really think about your life. You'd want to examine what had brought you to this point. Except that, from what I can tell, the American system of electoral politics, which is widely imitated around the world, and that's kind of the point, has bred the capacity for self-reflection out of elected representatives. That it seems that all over the world, there's nobody who's capable of stopping and thinking about their lives and their choices and how they got here. And I saw a great example of that just before I left Germany. The Green Party in Bavaria were proposing to put energy and electricity under control of the state. Sort of, I think, for two reasons. Firstly, to conceal the fact that they can no longer find private investors willing to put up money for wind and solar projects. And secondly, also to cover up the fact that they just forced the shutdown of a great big source of cheap electricity, which was partly owned by the Municipal Electric Utility of Munich. Nuclear power plant Isar 2 was part owned by the Stadtwerk München. Stadtwerk München, yeah. And so now they're proposing to sort of make energy production a state business after they, you know, really, really messed up the existing publicly owned energy provision business. Anyway, please send those cards and letters to Man and Atom, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. If you'd like to support these broadcasts, paypal.me/prometheuslives, patreon.com/man_